All right, Larry Johnson, thank you for being back on Rating Craters. This is the third time I believe we've had you on, and it's always super informative. And the world only gets crazier every time, you know, that we talk. It hasn't gotten any better. And I wanted to have you back on to get kind of an idea of how you see things going in Ukraine at the moment. It does seem that when you say, how are things going in Ukraine, that situation has gotten so much more multifaceted. It's how are things going between the collective West and the BRIC nations, really? And how's the collapse of the dollar going? There's so much going on. So I've got you on the show. It's great that you're back on. And maybe I'd start asking, do you think this is the most dangerous moment of our times right now? Is this kind of a longer version of the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yeah, this is the most dangerous moment, I think, in U.S. history, frankly, with the potential ramifications if it goes nuclear. The problem we have is that nobody in the Biden administration has any genuine intelligence and wisdom in order to avoid escalating tensions. They almost seem intent on provoking Russia and China as much as they can without really pausing to consider the consequences if Russia is compelled to use nuclear weapons to defend itself. So, this surpasses the Cuban Missile Crisis in terms of the peril to the American nation.
Yeah, and it makes me think about, as I've heard mentioned on the, you know, Duran several times, you know, that they don't have a reverse gear, you know, the escalation elevator. And it seems that one thing that gets me is this really, so we all know that there was, we certainly know there was a Cold War, and we certainly know that there was a, you know, project for a new American century that, you know, came out, that seemed to be made fairly public during the George W. Bush years, I think. And I mean, is this really just, it's almost hard to believe, but is this really just the plan? I mean, but the plan isn't going quite well. If the I think Project for a New American Century was correct, if that was a real document, then the balkanization of Russia was sort of scheduled. It just seems that to continue pushing that plan, if that's what it was, it really is a complete denial of reality, even at the start of this.
Mm-hmm. No, well, what we're witnessing is a fundamental transformation of the world order, the international system that was erected in the aftermath of World War II, consisting of the United Nations, International Monetary Fund, World Bank. These different organizations had at the heart of it U.S. control. And so this notion of an international rules order is really the underlying premise, is that the United States, it's the rules work in the U.S. favor. So whatever the U.S. wants, the U.S. gets. And for, you know, we're looking at over 70 years, the United States was able to essentially bully, cajole, sometimes entice other countries to do what we wanted. That's over. That is over in a big way. And the United States has not yet come to grips with that. And certainly the vast majority of the American people don't realize what the implications of that are. But, you know, we've seen the subtle shifts, such as Honduras, let's call it a poodle attached to the leash held by the United States, separated itself, withdrew recognition of Taiwan as the Republic of China, and recognize the People's Republic of China as the legitimate government. The agreement between Brazil and China to start making payments in oil with the yuan and the Brazilian currency. The decision of Saudi Arabia to join BRICS and to realign with Iran to intervention by the Chinese. So it's not just one thing. It is a whole series of things. And at the heart of it is a U.S. dollar that is so heavily leveraged. And what I mean by leveraged is we've been borrowing money from other people, and they've been taking our IOU, our promise to pay them back, you know, next Tuesday for a hamburger today, it puts us as one of the poorest nations in the world in reality, if you look at it in terms of that debt load. So that entire system's becoming unraveled, and the new architects are Russia and China. And Russia and China in league with India, South Africa, Brazil, other countries will be joining, Iran, Saudi Arabia. So, you know, within the next 5 years, the United States is going to find itself actually quite isolated compared to what the situation was 10 years ago.
And when I think about the BRIC nations, how they're expanding, it does make sense because, of course, I think the first thing everybody noticed when this started was, of course, that, you know, Russia had, you know, gone into eastern Ukraine, and many people thought, I understand they'll think, oh, you know, Putin just woke up and decided to do that. But of course, history didn't start that day. There's a lot of reasons for this happening, and people are beginning to slowly understand that. I actually talked to a couple that came here from Ukraine just a couple months ago, and I thought these guys would be great to talk to. I had no idea what their, you know, what they thought, but in talking to them, I realized that even people in Ukraine, at least those two, they really didn't know what was going on in their country. They had about the knowledge as your average American does, you know. They had no idea that the more, I'd say, the extremist militias, you could say, of Ukraine had been shelling the Donbas area for ever since 2014. Like, this is news to them. And I'm like, you live there, right? And like, yeah, they thought that they'd never bombed, that they'd never used artillery against any Russian city ever. And I thought, wow, you live there. This is happening just how many miles from your house? This is being fired, you know, and you don't know. So it's amazing how even people in the Ukraine don't necessarily know the larger implications of what's going on.
Yeah, well, this is what we've witnessed taking place over the last 30 years, 35 years, is the breakup of individual independent media. That the media has been consolidated increasingly in a smaller and smaller number of large corporations. And that corporate culture takes over and actually controls what can be said, what can be covered. For example, CBS News just sent a memo to its employees saying that they were not to refer to the transgender woman who believes she was a man, as transgender, even though she killed three children and three adults. So that is just typical. You don't get coverage of the fact that the Maidan was a coup engineered by the British and the Americans, help of allies inside Ukraine to oust the democratically elected president, legitimate president, and to remove him in an unconstitutional manner. So without understanding that as context, and then understanding what ensued in the aftermath of that coup with direct military attacks on the Russian-speaking citizens that occupy Donetsk, Luhansk. It's easy to just believe that, as you said, Vladimir Putin woke up one day and said, oh, I have an ambition to conquer your country, so let's go. That has been actually the exact opposite, even under Soviet times. The Russians have not been an imperialist occupying force. That hasn't been their method of operating. Quite a contrast with what the United States' history and legacy is, as I put.
Yes, and this does represent kind of, well, ultimately a unipolar world, I think, already exists at this point, and this is more This is the fallout from it. This is just a natural reorganization of the world, really. And one of the things that I've just been thinking about recently in this conflict, for some reason, it just comes to mind, is when the Russia, you know, goes into eastern Ukraine. It wasn't that long after the initial, you could say, special military operation. I do believe Zelensky, president of Ukraine, was meeting with, I don't think it was Putin exactly, but I think it was in Istanbul, that they actually were meeting and trying to negotiate. Right. And that was in the works. And I remember it was shortly after that that Boris Johnson went over to speak to you, to Zelensky, and must have said, no, you're not allowed to do that, because he changed his tone. But also, this is a strange spot for, I think, Zelensky and the Ukraine itself and the whole situation, where there was a video, and I tried to find it before this and I couldn't find it, but there's a video where Zelensky early on went to some of the militias, I call them the ultra-nationalist or far-right militias, don't, I guess you call them Nazi if you want, but you know, the ultra-nationalist militias. Yeah. And he was talking to some of them and he was saying, look, I'm trying to negotiate. You guys have to pull back so I can negotiate. And they just told him to F off. And I realized like that, I realized what a moment that was. A different, I think that day Zelensky became something else. I think he realized that he was screwed, because the collective West was not going to let him negotiate. And ultimately the far right militias or Nazi militias just.
You froze there. Hello.
Come.
Yeah,
that is to a resolution militarily, and we're back. I think.
Yeah, you're back.
Oh, now we're back. I think. Okay, I hear you. So we're in the beginning of the conflict. I saw Zelensky, go to the go to his people, the Nazi militias in the trenches, and they were like, "Get lost! We're not going to pull back, even though you want to negotiate with Putin, with Russia, to have some kind of negotiate something early in the game." Boris Johnson came and said, "No, you're not going to do that." So it seems like, as far as the Zelensky regime, the powers that be in Ukraine, the West won't let him negotiate, and the far right sector basically will not let him negotiate. So really, there's no option for Ukraine but forward in this.
Well, correct. They've made a conscious choice not to negotiate, but candidly, there's not a lot to negotiate about. What Russia wanted was basic security for the people of the Donbas, and the Ukrainians were unwilling to relinquish that and to move the artillery, stop the bombardments. Ukraine wants Crimea back. There's no way in hell that Russia's going to relent and give up Crimea. So right there, you've got two immovable objects, as it were. I don't quite see how you get around that. Where this is headed, just as the Confederates had to surrender at Appomattox, just as the Japanese had to get on board a ship in Tokyo Bay, in Missouri, sign an agreement. That's where it's headed for Ukraine. Ukraine is going to be beaten, defeated militarily. And really, by extension, it will be a major defeat for the United States and for NATO. Because despite all of the weapons, all of the money, all of the so-called Wunderwaffen, the wonder weapons they've been poured in, it was all for naught.
Yeah, and there's even something about hearing that term, you know, like the Wunderwaffen, like the wonder weapons. That's just so, if anybody knows World War II history, it's just weird to even use that term, and it's being used these days, you know, like they're hoping for the wonder weapon. Maybe the V3 will terrify the East into giving up. But yeah, so it does seem that early in the game, when there was an attempt at negotiations, it seems like it became impossible because the West said no, and then the far right sector of the Nazis basically would hang Zelensky anyway. So there was no way but forward, and it's interesting how these like unintended consequences or whenever you start a war, you never know what's going to happen, and so it seems like, I don't know, not to dwell on it, but it seems like maybe. I don't know, maybe Zelensky was somewhat naive in the beginning, and then he realized that they were going to hang him if he didn't just keep going forward, and so that's what we got, you know, because the West won't allow it, and the far right militias won't allow it either. So one thing about
there's a great lack of critical thinking being demonstrated. For example, there's a lot of criticism directed at Russia for being having a second-rate, third-rate military and losing men and growing great, very weak. Well, this British colonel, a guy named Kemp, wrote the other day that very nonsense. And, you know, think of this. Here is a guy whose army, the British army, total strength, total manpower, 73,000 troops. Now, that wouldn't even fill, I wrote about this, wouldn't even fill the University of Alabama football stadium. You'd still have 27,000 free seats. And what's the Russian military? Oh, it's 1.5 million. Yeah, 73,000 against 1.5 million. And it's the Russians who are weak and incompetent. So you get that kind of crazy statements from people who should know better, all the while dismissing and minimizing the Russian military capability. In my book, you're better off exaggerating the capability. So, because that's what we did for years during the Cold War. During the Cold War, when we needed to present Russia as the greatest military threat in the world, the then Soviet Union, their capabilities were dramatically expanded and talked about as being so consequential. Well, now we're doing just the opposite. And the danger in that is it leaves the American people quite ignorant and willing to back policies that if they were properly informed, they would not back. So that we've underestimated the quality, size, efficiency, effectiveness of the Russian military. Done the same with respect to the Russian economy. That's where the West really thought that by derailing those negotiations between Zelensky and the Russians, that the United States, the economic pressures would be so great that Russia would be forced to collapse. And nobody in the West really took time to think about it and realize that Russia is a self-independent state, self-producer. That does not depend in any measurable way upon imports from other countries. It is an exporting nation. And those other countries, you know, they're not exporting McDonald's hamburgers and Happy Meals. They're exporting things that the other countries absolutely need and can't survive without.
Yeah. And also the relationships that China and India have with Russia as it is. I mean, it did appear rather quickly in this as this conflict ensued was that India, you know, America scolded India for not playing the game, and India just right. kind of said, "Look, this is our we share a border. Like this is our neighbor. We honestly need them more than we need you." You know,
right?
So, yeah.
Well, that's what we mm-hmm. talked about earlier. That's what we talked about earlier. The breakdown of that international order, the unipolar world that was controlled, dominated by the United States. There's one more example. India said, "Hey, go pound sand. Leave us alone. We'll take care of our own affairs."
Yeah, and it seems like that's the thing that when I watch the collective West, watch America, always forward. They just keep provoking. They just seem to be unattached to that reality that if this is not a battle for the unipolar world order, this is the reality of the unipolar world order already existing. You know, so it does seem like when you say a lack of critical thinking, it just seems that it's critical thinking, and then even being aware of, you know, what's going on in the world, what's happened the last few decades. You know, and with that, you've got China gave us a little bit of a scolding, I do believe, recently, saying we should have our troops out of Syria, you know?
Yeah.
And I look at that and I think, well, okay, so Iran's already part of the BRIC nations. Saudi Arabia, it just seems like they haven't signed the paperwork yet, but in effect they are. You know, it would not surprise me if Iraq wanted to be, especially when you look at Syria. So I wonder if Syria will be a BRIC nation in 2023, because we have troops there, of course, protecting the Syrian people from their oil and wheat, you know, or making sure they don't get any of that because for their safety. We have troops there. A lot of Americans don't even know we have troops there, but now the heat's getting turned up. And so I wonder if this year we might even see the West kicked out of Syria and then Syria just join the BRICS. That would definitely be kind of a bit of a, that would definitely be a Western defeat, I think, right there.
Yeah. Well, it's a dramatic change, altering 12 years of history now. Go back to 2011 with the Arab Spring, as it was called at the time. One of the leading countries in that effort was Algeria. And as part of that, a whole Arab Spring, which was engineered, I believe, by through U.S. and British intelligence activities. They ultimately convinced Turkey and the Arab states in the Gulf to spend money and target Bashar Assad in order to change the government in Syria. So Syria was under attack by Turkey in the north, was under attack by Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, via money sent to terrorist organizations. And the United States itself was helping actively arm and supply radical Islamic terrorists. In the previous years, insisted were our greatest threat, greatest enemy. We had to stop them at any cost. Now we realize they just became a convenient scapegoat. We trotted it when we needed it to raise money. So now you're in a situation where Algeria has given the go-ahead to a diplomat to represent it in Syria. Syria is being re-invited into a number of capitals to have ambassadors, diplomatic representation. So this, again, this is something that the United States tried to engineer to prevent from taking place, and it's just going the opposite direction. Between Syria's relationship with both Russia and China are facilitating this movement.
Yeah, and that definitely is a big change. And so I think that when we look at these things that are happening, it seems that as the proxy war maybe comes to a head in Ukraine, I mean, that would be the end of NATO in effect, wouldn't it? I mean, it might still exist, but I think that it would be done for.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're not going to have... NATO has basically disarmed itself in the process of trying to send weapons to Ukraine. None of NATO countries, not even Germany anymore, have the industrial base and capability to mass produce weapons systems, artillery shells, tanks, planes, in a rapid manner and inexpensive manner to sustain an armed force in the field. And that's been one of the things that we've witnessed with Ukraine. Even the Ukrainians admit that, for every 1,000 shells they fire, the Russians fire 8,000, 9,000 back at them. Well, just on a sheer scale of that disparity, that means Ukraine is going to suffer more casualties simply because there are more shells being fired at it. There's no way that you would get more casualties on the Russian side than are being incurred on the Ukrainian side. And the difference in casualties is probably, it's a fact, it's that multiplier. It's probably, the Ukrainians probably have suffered at least 8 times the casualties the Russians have. So if you've got 20,000 dead Russians, you're looking at 160,000 dead Ukrainians.
No, it would make sense. And that's the thing. I think one of the things that we're seeing right now is the outcome when you have politicians that run a war, or you might say politicians that run an arms industry, a military itself, versus something way more practical like Russia. you know, because you make a lot of money when you develop and manufacture an F-22 or an F-35, et cetera. That's a lot of money, very sexy, very, very good. Yes, people made a lot of money. It was a great moneymaker for a lot of people, but the older MiGs that got retrofitted to land on dirt runways, that I think is more impressive, to be honest with you. That's pretty good stuff. And then also things that are not sexy, things that are not interesting in an arms industry that don't quite cost as much, like artillery. You know, I've seen pictures of the factories in Russia, and they're just kicking them out. I mean, they have no problems creating untold how many shells a day. But the thing is, though, that's something that you sort of pay for isn't really, there's not a lot of profit for the companies making it. It's not quite, you might say, like the Western model where everybody makes a lot of money and you have weapons that may or may not work or not tested versus artillery. The Russians know from World War II, especially, artillery works and they're kicking it out like crazy, you know. But you know what, the manufacturer makes what, $5 a shell? I don't know, but it's not a big money maker. But that's, it's so funny where you're seeing where America has the most expensive military in the world, but maybe Russia has not the most expensive, but maybe the most effective.
Well, it's certainly the most cost effective and the most technologically sophisticated, far more sophisticated than the United States. As an example, in the M1 Abrams tank, even the modern version of it, you have a four-member crew because one of those guys has to pick the shell up and load it. The Russians, their latest tank, the T-90, has an automatic loader.
Yes.
They don't, so they can go with three crewmen. So just by virtue of having three crewmen, it's a cheaper system. And it's a more effective system. It's not dependent upon having one guy who could lift a shell into place and put it in the breach. The real big difference is that Russia's defense industry is designed around a clear strategy of national defense. And everything that is produced is done in concert with addressing that strategy. Whereas in the United States, as you noted, it really is more of a political process. And even something as simple, perhaps, as the production of an artillery shell can get spread out in four or five different states simply because a member of Congress who's going to vote for an appropriation wants to have some jobs come to his district or her district so they can say, look at what a great person I am because we got the relationship with Lockheed Martin or General Dynamics or Raytheon, just run down the list. So that is... you end up building weapon systems that are designed to satisfy political needs as opposed to actually systems that work well in difficult environments and that can be effective and be sustained in the field without frequent breakdowns or need for maintenance.
Yeah. It's like we know that, we know howitzers work without a doubt. They certainly do, Well, I do wonder, when do you, I mean, I know you might say it started in 1945, but I wonder, when did Russia start preparing for this? Because I think that, I'm not really sure, because I think about, let's say like the George W. Bush years and going, actually even his dad, the Bush Sr., it seemed like by our actions, we were proving the reality that we are going to do the Project for a New American Century. Like, we're coming for you. So it seems like the BRIC nations, China, Russia, like they got a lot of forewarning that this was coming. So it seems like they've been getting ready for a while, because as we watch this unfold, Putin didn't just wake up and decide to, go into Ukraine.
Well, it's gone through phases. When Putin became president, there was still a widespread belief and desire among the Russian elite to have an alliance with the West and they actually tried to ingratiate themselves with Washington and London in order to find a place at the table and be treated like one of the Western nations. West was not interested in it at all. And then when Putin took the steps to close out the oligarchs from being able to rape Russia of its resources and to force them into a more responsible economic relationship with the nation, that is where the real animus started and the desire to get rid of Putin, because Putin basically is an obstacle to the West being able to rape Russia of all of its natural resources. Russia is really at the top in terms of the wealthiest country in terms of natural resources of all countries in the world. So the best way to describe it is the West lusts after what Russia has. They want to take it. They want to control it. And Russia is saying very clearly, no, you're not going to take us and control us. Russia has been one of the few countries that has been immune to the imperial ambitions of other countries. Fought the Crimea War against the Brits and French, I believe. And in that war, efforts were made by the West to take over Russian territory. And the Russians have been constantly pushing Westerners out. And that goes back even to World War II with the Nazi invasion of Russia. The Russians were ultimately able to completely annihilate the German army that had attacked it in Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah. And it definitely seems that the that memory of how to wipe a military out is still there, because that's the thing with the with the special military operation from the very start, as Putin said, to denazify. A lot of people, they focus on territory, and I think maybe Russia's got about as much territory as it wants. And the media focuses a lot on this town or that town being taken, but Russia's just doing, as they say, like positional warfare. They're just there to slowly, basically, delete NATO's military, basically.
Well, the thing the West completely ignores or doesn't appreciate is the role of the Eastern Orthodox Christian Church within Russian society today. And that battle against the Eastern Orthodox Christians, it's also being carried out by Ukraine. Ukraine is attacking the clergy in Kiev in particular, at the Lavra, which is important shrine church in Kiev. And you got to ask yourself, why? Well, when you look at the Azov battalion members, and many that are surrounding Zelensky, it's almost a satanic cult. They're pagan, and they desecrate and want to destroy all things pertaining to Catholic, to Christianity, both from the Catholic side and, or more importantly, from the Russian Eastern Orthodox side. So that is fully underway now, and is, I think, tied directly at what is behind all of this, the effort to crush the Christians. And part of it goes to an international agenda that the West is avidly supporting, the expansion of homosexuality, the LGBTQ community, and Russia's pushing back against that. And I think that is itself another cause of to make Russia a pariah, because Russia is not going to play along with that notion that men can be women and women can be men. No, they've rejected that and been very public in their rejection.
Yeah, I think as Putin, I forget the quote exactly, but he said something like, "We have certain standards here, aren't compatible with that." And the thing that gets me is, we are seeing that. We're seeing the Orthodox Church, which is recognized by many there in Ukraine. I mean, it's where they go. And we're seeing the Zelensky regime basically arrest clergy. I think we actually saw just recently, video of one of the higher ups in the church, I forget exactly who it is, getting an ankle bracelet, which is crazy. Right, so the world is seeing this. I don't know how many are noticing. I don't know how many are really seeing it, but this is public. They're not hiding this, you know? So they're attacking the Russian Orthodox Church, and they're, as they put it, inventorying what is there in the churches. I would basically just say stealing. And I think Zelensky actually was quoted as saying that they weren't going to let that like the Russian Orthodox Church like poison the spiritual mind of the Ukraine or something like that. So he's made some wild statements. So, you know, we're supporting this, and it just gets me how, well, I'm not really sure if the American, where, how do you think, the American public is even aware, or the American public supports that? It seems like it doesn't really matter what we think anyway.
Well, a few are, but most are not. And I'm afraid that the ignorance will persist until there is a devastating event that will lead to the destruction of some significant portions of U.S. military force. And it'll only be in the aftermath of that kind of disaster that there'll be finally a willingness and openness to recognize that Russia is not what we said it is. When Russia crushes, takes out an aircraft carrier battle group, for example, where the people are going to wake up and say, wait, I thought they were on the ropes. I thought they were running out of ammunition. I thought, you know, they had no air force. And once that lie is fully exposed, then you've got an opportunity to start walking back and trying to repair the damage to the relationship with Moscow. But right now, at this point, I don't. There is no foundation for reestablishing a base. You know, just not. It's gone.
Yeah, and this, I think, of course, this has been in planning for quite a while, because we also have a. I'm not sure if it's a war on the dollar, or maybe it's the dollar that the war has had on the world, which is now that battle's turning, you know, against the dollar's favor, but. I think it was called the SAN 100. I meant to look it up before this, but I think that's what it was called. But there's an incredible, there's a lot of nations that are moving away from, you know, the dollar. And I think even this morning I saw an article where Japan, they broke from the G7 and they said, nope, we're going to buy Russian oil, and we're going to buy it above the cap you guys think you can set. And that's just what we're doing, because we're not going to... We're not going to, I mean, I don't know, could the Japanese government even stay solvent if they didn't do that? So in a sense, we're seeing, I mean, I could have made a long list before the show, but there's so much, the dollar is being more and more ignored between nations. I think didn't even France, I think, recently buy a yuan settled oil, I think it was. So, I mean, we're seeing...
Yeah.
Even who supposedly would be the West or America's allies, they're just going, you know, we've had enough. We're going to, both allies and then those that are not our allies are stepping away from the dollar, and they're doing it very boldly. I think that Russia, like for the first time just recently, did more trade in, I think, the yuan than any other currency or something like that. It's hard to even, there's so much news coming in about de-dollarization, and it seems like the world, especially the BRIC nations, are really, really happy to get on board with that. So it seems like we've created a lot of animosity over the decades, ever since Bretton Woods, and those chickens are coming home to roost, and that's definitely a part of this conflict that can't be ignored.
Yeah, I'd almost say it probably goes to the heart of the conflict, because right now the United States is desperately battling to try to protect the international reserve status of the dollar. Then that means that anybody that wants to do any business internationally has to do it in dollars. That's gone. That is now being, there are now alternatives emerging, more alternatives emerging. And within that, the United States, by virtue of basically borrowing money, we borrow from the Germans by selling them our T-bills. We borrow from the Chinese. The Chinese used to be one of the largest holders of U.S. bonds. Chinese have been selling those off at a rapid pace. But that means the United States ends up owing everybody in the world money, and we don't have it all. Because the transformation that has occurred in the U.S. economy is gone from having a robust, extensive, sophisticated, advanced industrial base where you had factories that could produce things and people that knew how to work in factories and run that sophisticated equipment. That's gone. I've commented on my childhood home in Independence, Missouri. Growing up, we had Standard Oil, we had Sheffield Steel, then later our Armco Steel. We had the Bendix Corporation, we had General Motors Needs Plant. All those plants are gone. They're all gone. And those plants used to offer strong jobs, you know, that paid well and brought benefits, including health care and other things, and retirement programs. They're gone. So people are left. What are their alternatives? Go to McDonald's, flip burgers. Maybe you get a sales manager, you know, manage a McDonald's. But in terms of actually building something that's productive and contributes to the genuine wealth of a nation, America doesn't do that anymore. It does it very rarely. It doesn't do it commonly.
That's very true. If one drives through like Buffalo, New York, or Detroit, you see, you know, even though there's been some rejuvenation, you see pretty much these proud old factories, many made of brick, you know, that have trees growing through them now.
Right.
You know,
right.
And you just
right.
go, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what, you know, what the United States is up against. Russia can actually make things because the Russians have a more educated population. I think the stat is that American Russian high school students on average have three times the amount of biology, chemistry, physics, mathematics than do the graduates of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Oh my
God. Think about that. You got high school students that have far more scientific education than graduates from what is considered one of our leading scientific higher institutions of higher education. So, and then Russia actually has factories where they can build rocket engines. We know that because the United States has been hitching a ride from the Russians to the space station for, you know, over 20 years. They produce artillery shells. They produce tanks. They produce planes. They produce what they need because they have it there. They don't have to depend upon imports from the United States in order to build these things. And that's what the United States hasn't caught up to.
Yeah. Russia can make plenty of artillery to blow up, you know, to blow up NATO soldiers. And that's the thing when you mentioned like a war on, you know, it being a war on the church on a certain, well, actually outright war on the church, you could say by Ukraine at this moment outright, you know, but then of course, let's say a passive aggressive proxy war on the church, like here in this country, which a person doesn't have to be a churchgoer, just that, I don't know, just historic norms that we've always had. And I think that this is definitely a different nation. I think one of the things that we have that is a challenge in this situation is, like here in Phoenix, if you go up north, you see where FDR's CCC, I think they called it, the Civil Corps of something, where during the Great Depression,
Civilian Conservation Corps.
Civilian Conservation Corps. When you look at what these guys did, they made $30 a month. They sent 25 home. That's how it was set up. Most of them did. And they were it's kind of like being in the military. They were feeding you, you know, things were taken care of. But these guys with a few pieces of equipment, mostly wheelbarrows and shovels and pickaxes, and they're still up there today. They made some of the most extraordinary huge ditches and such. They basically managed the water so that Phoenix and Scottsdale didn't get wiped out by flash floods. I mean, what they did was extraordinary managing the lands. And I wonder today, you know, if that would even be possible? Like, do the American youth of that time that did that, do those exist today? And I think that's one of our great challenges too. It's just that there's a certain pride and patriotism, you know, that I look at the pictures of all that stuff being built, and you can go and you can walk along it. It's so impressive. Right. It's this handmade concrete in wheelbarrows. They made these incredible structures that are impressive. And I just think, wow, you know, I know there's some Americans that have that in them, but I think the whole idea, the kind of, you know, pushing that social Marxist ideal, you know, there's just no, where America's missing something to truly fight that conflict with the East right now, I think.
Well, yes, the American industry is described as being financialized. It's based primarily upon it's a service economy. And by virtue of being a service economy, it means, you know, the Uber driver that drops the food off, the food worker that makes the food, the gas station attendant that provides the fuel for the car, even the guys selling cars. Again, that's a service industry. They're not making the cars themselves. A lot of times those cars are being made overseas. So the U.S. industry is not in a position, as we have discovered, that's been one of the revelations out of this war in Ukraine, that the United States does not have unlimited supplies of any weapon systems, particularly HIMARS and artillery shells and tanks that it can quickly dispatch to Ukraine and then quickly rebuild, restock its own stores. But it can't do it. And has admitted as much. So once you recognize you're in that kind of a dilemma, then you're no longer in a position to fight the expeditionary war, which is candidly all the United States has been fighting for the last 110 years, actually.
Yeah, especially when you're fighting, you know, like Russia does not have exactly extended supply lines to Ukraine, where we definitely do, you know? Yeah. And along with the de-dollarization, I thought I'd just throw that in there that, you know, it was just recently Saudi Arabia was saying that we're open for business. We don't have to trade only in the dollar. And I think they're doing some trade outside of the dollar now. So that's a big one too. And then people definitely have taken note of that. They'll say, wow, I thought they were our allies. But, well, you know, every nation has their reasons. And so we're seeing quite the changing world there. Well, here's a question that I wanted to ask was, why Wagner? And what I mean by that is, you know, I've often thought an amazing book to write would be like The Way of the Mercenary. All the mercenary through time is they've always been with us. They've always been an aspect of a military. And it seems that, of course, the Russian military is involved, but it seems like Wagner really is their spearhead. And why? Why are the mercenaries so effective? What role do you think they're playing in this?
Well, they're well-trained. There's a video out I just saw the other day going through some of the training, how Wagner trains its troops. Did a very good job. You know, frankly, I don't think U.S. military forces get as good training. The, you know, in some aspects, the Wagner force is very much like the French Foreign Legion.
Mm-hmm.
Foreign Legion is always a place where criminals and people who needed to work out problems in life could go and serve. And they operated in Africa as a you know, an extension of French military power to control local African countries. The Wagner group has been used as a tool, not to impose imperial rule, but to actually help countries get control of their destiny, particularly in Africa. But they also, it's a large enough operation. It's not entirely comprised of prisoners by any stretch, but it is a private sector outfit that offers some benefits that the regular military doesn't. However, it is still under and subservient to chain of command by General Gerasimov and General Surovikin.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, Wagner is in Africa, and that's an interesting one because we've got, you know, recently Macron was in France, and I think he kind of got, what was that quote he said? Macron says the era of French interference in Africa is over, you know, when he went to a couple of African countries trying to rally support, but they pretty much, they were blatant. They had nothing nice to say to him, and they pretty much kicked his ass out of the country. And it does seem that this is one of the things that we're seeing there, especially with BRICS, that last, you know, letter S, you know, Africa, South Africa. It does seem that they're very happy to be doing, it seems like they really have, you know, nailed their colors to the mast. They're with the BRIC nations. And it does seem that because the BRIC, you know, dealing with Russia, dealing with the BRICS, basically it's a better deal for them. They're not getting genocided as part of the trade deal.
Well, legacy of colonialism in Africa is come to an end. That's the one thing that neither China nor Russia, even though the West likes to talk about China and Russia's intent on conquering the globe, it's a psychological projection, because China and Russia have not been routinely sending out their military forces into other countries to occupy those countries and then to abscond with the resources. It's been just the opposite. It's been the United States followed in the footsteps of the British, of the French, of the Germans, of the Dutch, of the Italians. Those are the principal countries that controlled vast swaths of territory in Africa. And it was always a note that they were it was a new form of servitude. There was slavery without having to be put on the slave ships and sent overseas. Now that the Africans are wealthy enough that they can push back, and the influence of those companies are out. I mean, the countries are out. And that's where people like the Wagner Group and others come in to fill a gap, but to help, where they are genuinely training the local soldiers so that they can work with and help the local population, as opposed to seeing that local population as a threat.
Yeah. Makes me wonder if that's an aspect of India, you know, being happy with the happier being part of the new BRICS system, in that, you know, most people you know from India have a very strong European accent, you know, and, you know, I mean, Gandhi was a big deal, and maybe that memory is not gone. So when we say, hey, we need you to destroy yourselves financially so that we can colonize and, you know, balkanize Russia, maybe they think, maybe you can just take care of that yourself.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's just one other dimension of this change that we talked about at the outset, that is transforming the world. And the United States is no longer in control of it. And that frustrates and scares the hell out of the Washington political class, because they're starting to recognize that this party is over.
Yeah. And that's, and I'd ask, what part of that do you think, you know, scares them? So I understand, you know, putting up a fight, you figure, okay, we're going to try to keep the dollar, you know, the reserve currency, we're going to try to keep our, you might say, unipolar dominance. But if it's already gone, if you've already lost, like, what's the point of fighting? And that's what worries me, where I feel like this is a dangerous time, because it really feels like we're fighting a battle that we've already lost. And the art of war says that's a bad idea.
Right. Well, you can lose a battle, not lose a war. I mean, we've seen that repeatedly throughout history. What the United States is losing is the war.
The war, I should say. It's
akin to having, you know, the United States was like a guy that had 15 girlfriends, and you could always count on those girlfriends to do what he wanted. And most of those women in a relationship with him was an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. Well, now all of a sudden he's calling him up, saying, "Hey, I'll take you out for dinner tonight. Now I got other plans." And, you know, got other plans. Actually, I'm going out with somebody else. I'm going out with the Chinese. I'm going out with the Russians. Wait a second. You know, you're my girl. Well, it used to be, no longer. That's what Saudi Arabia said. That's what India, in effect, is saying.
Yes. So
that kind of an equitable relationship with the United States, dominated for so many years, is gone, or it's being eroded, it's being unmade right before our eyes, and it's happening in real time.
And I wonder if there's something that gives me, when on the onset of this, of course, we did, well, the I guess it was where the EU froze Russian funds. And I think that that definitely made the world, if they needed something to push them over the edge to go, we're going BRICS, we're getting away from the SWIFT system, we're getting away from the dollar, was the freezing of the Russian assets. Because once you realize that if you're dealing with the Western banks, then your funds are just not safe. And I kind of also wonder if something that started this, because all things end up being connected. You look at in Canada, the trucker strike, basically.
Trucker protests.
Yeah. And those trucker protests, when the funds were frozen in people's bank accounts, I think that was a big one too. So I think they may seem separate, but you look at the trucker protests, you look at freezing of the Russian assets on when this started, it does definitely lend a lot of countries, like Saudi Arabia, for example, just going, you know what, let's just get out of the dollar because we cannot trust them. It's if you don't do what the West wants and you got your money in a Western bank, that thing's getting turned off.
Right. Well, the United States, until recently, until the Biden administration, was still seen as a safe haven where you could park your money and your money would not be confiscated or taken at a whim. Then in comes Biden, and then they start signing these executive orders, and then they go, they decide to go after Russia, banning it from using SWIFT. And so they, this kind of threat, it became, it wasn't just the Russian government, it was Russian, wealthy Russians, some who had actually thought that they were friends with the United States. They shared the U.S. distaste and disgust for Putin, dislike for Putin. And all of a sudden, they were having their ships, their yachts, their bank accounts seized. So countries around the world start looking and go, you know what? We don't want to be in a relationship with somebody who thinks they can take whatever we have whenever they want it, because simply they're mad at, they don't like how we're doing something that is in our interest, in our national interest. We're not going to subject ourselves to being hostage like that. And that's why they're breaking away, which it's interesting. It's going to end up strengthening countries like Iran and North Korea, because the willingness of an international community to continue to make people into economic pariahs is over.
Yeah. And I think that, what was it? Was North Korea, was, did I just read that they were, you know, that they had volunteer troops to go and fight as well, or something like that? So,
well, that was a story circulating out there. I don't have a lot of stock in it for several reasons. One, why North Korean troops on the Russian front lines doesn't make any sense. Language is a problem. Who's going to be translating and giving them orders? It's just it can be done, but it's a very cumbersome system that you have to put in place. They have not done a lot of extensive training together. And so being able to know what their capabilities are and what they can do, that I think is just probably more Western propaganda designed to create fear in the West, to encourage people to stick with this support for this stupid war.
Yeah. And just to revisit Wagner for a second, it is mentioned so much that in the Western media that it's all convicts and such. But I think that if you look at their performance, that's obviously not true. Yes, there might be, you know, the convicts, and of course. But I look at that as, you know, like in World War II, the Germans had the penal battalions. If you screwed up, you went and you had to, you know, clear minefields or do things that would probably get you killed. So I'm sure that they have, maybe Wagner has troops they don't care about as much, and that might be the convicts. But no, nothing performs that well that's only convicts, because you really cannot keep military discipline and really have a cohesive unit that is a bunch of convicts. That's just not possible, I don't think.
Well, when you, like I said, if you watch the videos of their training and of their operations,
I gotta watch.
They do not look anything like a ragtag group of criminals. They are well organized, well trained, and they operate with some discipline. So it's I think they're a valid organization.
Definitely a valid organization, and also the pipeline. So one thing about like some of the Russian oligarchs realizing that they're not America's ally. Something I've noticed in the greater Ukrainian conflict, which it just grows basically, is I think from what I've been noticing, it seems that we're seeing more of a BRICS cohesion, more nations being happy to do business there after the Nord Stream pipeline was blown up. I'm noticing it, right. Are you seeing that? Because that to me sent a pretty clear message that does America have any allies anymore?
Not really. No, it's shrinking. Japan, Japan is a little more tepid these days. Probably our quote strongest ally would be the Brits. But the Germans, the French, the Italians, they're not terribly enthusiastic about supporting the United States. So and our policy approach, how we talk to other countries and then the threats we make are not the kinds of communications that will enhance your position and bring you more support. Just opposite. It drives people away, creates wedges.
A lot of the rhetoric, like you look at Annalena Baerbock, saying, her line that, we're at war with Russia, actually admitting it. And many European and Western leaders have said such things. And then, of course, they'll turn around and say, no, we're not at war. We're just funding the war. We're not at war with you, but we're paying for it. And that just doesn't really work very well. Well, I've had you for almost an hour. I don't want to keep you too long, but I was going to ask, do you think that some of the protests that we're seeing, of course, we have protests in Israel, and I'm not a Netanyahu fan, but we have protests in Israel, we have protests in France against the pension reform. And I do wonder, do you think that these protests at all are being aided by the intelligence agencies here?
Well, I would say that I think some of the protests in Israel are being aided by Western intelligence.
Yeah,
I would suspect that some of the protests in France would be assisted by Russia, and China, but without, they don't have to do a lot. Courage. The French people are genuinely outraged at what was being proposed. We saw protests in Georgia against the government there. That was definitely provoked by the West and the Endowment for Democracy, National Endowment. So, you got to take it on a sort of a case by case basis. But there are clear examples of interference in the internal affairs of other countries. And while Russia is frequently mentioned in the U.S. press and in commentary as being a major culprit in that regard, the reality is the United States is the biggest interferer of any country in the world. And has established itself as the ultimate source of mayhem, chaos. To what end? It doesn't make a safer world. It doesn't make a more stable world. So
no, yeah. And even if at one time maybe it was a benefit in some situations, it isn't now. Lastly, I'd ask about. So we have some, I would say, some hawks here. Mentioning, we should send the military to Mexico because of the cartels. And when I heard that, at first I thought, well, whatever. But it made me think, gosh, are we trying to keep Mexico in line too? I mean, I wonder, like, could you imagine if, like, if Mexico wanted to join the BRICS? Now, that would be wild.
Well, actually, Mexico has said it's going to join BRICS.
Oh, see, there you go.
So they're gonna separate themselves. They don't like being the redheaded stepchild any more than anybody else. They want to be treated as an independent country. We used to spend a lot of time talking about the corruption in Mexico. Yeah, there's corruption in Mexico, but we live in a damn glass house in the United States. We're out throwing rocks. Our government is as corrupt as Mexico across the board. Just look at the double standards of judicial processes, the fact that people like the Bidens can become multimillionaires while on the public, taking public salary. It's just, and I think the Mexicans are tired of that. It's just like, leave us alone. Go take care of your own problems. It's frankly the drug problem that exists because of what Mexico supplies is because of what Americans are consuming.
Yes.
And everybody that, buys an illegal joint, they're part of the problem. And same, part of the problem. You are encouraging and enabling this behavior. So until Americans change their own values and attitudes, this problem is only going to get worse, I think.
I think so too. And yeah, well, and of course, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking, Mexico probably wants to start getting off the dollar standard, at least with some trade. And it wouldn't surprise me if they had interest in joining the BRICS. And you mentioned that they actually are, planning on doing that. And so, yeah, it makes sense. Oh, now all of a sudden we have to go take out their cartels and send our military to Mexico. And it almost seems like that's a move we could make, under the cover of the cartels. But that's a pretty vast that's a vast expanse, and we have so much. There's $1 billion-plus industry moving people across that border. I mean, that would be you're taking on. That would be an interesting conflict if that one started. Another way we can, end it all faster for ourselves. But just lastly, I would ask Trump. We all know. I think he just flew from Florida to New York, and that's an incredibly complex situation. But I guess big picture. If I was to super oversimplify it, it seems like I'm just calling it the Democrats at this point. We can call it the Uniparty Warhawks, whatever, if we want. But it seems like they really want to make Trump a felon so that he can't run, because I do think there's a good chance that he's not just talking rhetoric when he says he would put an end to this if he was elected.
Yeah. No, Trump has lots of flaws.
Yes.
That was been in his presidency. Terrible at selecting personnel.
Oh, the worst.
Terrible manager in that regard. He created a lot of his own problems. But his instincts, his baseline instincts are correct, where he recognizes, why do we need NATO? We don't need NATO. Oh, my God. You've got to have NATO. Why? Well, we've got to have all these jobs for all these U.S. generals. Otherwise, we'd have to cut the size of our defense budget, and we couldn't keep spending and putting money in the pockets of all these military industrial contractors. Oh, so, Trump was not willing to be bought off on that. And there's a real threat. I mean, that defense industry, when you think about it, our current defense budget exceeds all the Chinese, the Russian, the French, the German, and the British budgets combined. And those total up to be about half our expenditure. So we spend an inordinate amount of money. That's why I always described it, the phrase you used, most expensive military in the world, not the best. But in that regard, Trump has been a bit of an enabler of that mindset. We got the best military. I know he says that from a political standpoint, but I think he actually believes it, and it's not true. This attack on Trump is a deliberate effort to try, it's a desperate effort, I'd call it, to try to keep him from going to the White House. And actually, it seems to be having the exact opposite effect. It's forcing Republicans that are wanting to run against him in the primary to mute their attacks on Trump, because they recognize that what is being done to Trump is enraging. enraging large sections of Americans who think that this is unfair and it's inequitable. And it's just a further reminder that the, you know, you're trying to play poker in a house that's based on cheating. And the house rules are designed to cheat you out of your money. And that's kind of, and Trump knows how to play a violin, to sing that song and rally a populist movement behind it. So this is going to be pretty, I think, sequential.
Yeah, well, you know, Trump definitely does understand the art of the deal. He even wrote the book, Art of the Deal. And I remember when he was questioning NATO when he was president, you know, like, what's in this for us? Why are we paying for Europe's, you know, military? And it's like, that doesn't make sense. It's not a good deal. So I think that he definitely has flaws. Definitely, you know, I like him, but I definitely don't see him he's not a hero to me or anything like that, but he definitely made a lot of mistakes. Yeah, you're right. I mean, even right now he's going into this court battle and he doesn't even have a great legal team. There's like people that are so much better qualified that could represent him. So hopefully he gets out of this. And, you know, I would love to see, my hope is that there's back channels between Trump and Putin, and they pretty much just keep killing Nazis for a couple of years until he's president again. And we just, what a great easy out, you know, we can just blame it all on the Biden administration and move on, you know? Well,
I guarantee you there's one thing that is not happening, that Trump's not communicating with Putin, because that would feed into that meme that Trump is a puppet of Putin.
Yeah, I guess they're probably not communicating. It's unfortunate, but I tell you, they definitely look like people that could talk a deal when you see pictures when he was president, of Putin and Trump sitting there. Those two guys they can work this out. They definitely can. Big egos, but I think they actually care about the humans in their countries and even one another's countries not dying. So I think that they have that in common, and I think that they're, you know, good enough humans to make that happen, definitely. Well, Larry Johnson, it's been so great having you on. Is there any last thoughts you have about this conflict at the moment? And of course, where can people find you? Of course, we all know it's Sonar21, but let us know.
Yeah, just come on by sonar21.com, read, comment. And, you know, I think the war is taking a decided turn against Ukraine at a more rapid pace than some in the West had hoped. They were hoping that Ukraine would be able to mount, quote, a counteroffensive, and the possibilities of that, I think, are becoming diminishing with each passing day.
Yeah. And if they try it, they're just gonna run into a well-made, homegrown Russian artillery. That's all that's gonna happen. Yeah. All right. Well, exactly. Take care. Thank you so much for being on the show. I'll send you a link shortly.
All right, Craig. All right. Thanks so much, Mike.
Okay, bye. Talk to you later.